Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and welcome as always to Future Tense. For your discerning listening pleasure this week, we'll meet a man with ambitions to set up a world-class museum of science fiction.
Hi, I'm Greg Vigiano, and we're in the process of establishing the Museum of Science Fiction in Washington, D.C. We hope the museum will be a center of gravity where art and science are going to be powered by imagination.
And we'll also speak with Jeff Thompson from the Stevens Institute of Technology in New Jersey. He's going to try and justify why he spent his research facility's money watching hours and hours of TV. Only kidding. He's been clocking up the screen time all right, but all in the name of better understanding the evolution of digital technology and our changing attitudes toward it. What's he been watching? Here's a little hint.
In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. These are their stories.
Law and Order, of course. And how's this for dedication? Assistant Professor Thompson watched all 456 episodes. That's to come. But our program today begins in the United Kingdom.
You ask what is our policy. I will say it is to wage war by sea, land and air.
Back during the Second World War, they built a whole lot of air raid shelters in the centre of London. Well, they built a whole lot everywhere, but that's beside the point. One particular shelter was built in Clapham, and it's still there. It's a big one, and after sitting abandoned for more than half a century, it's now being given a new lease of life by a company called Zero Carbon Food. I mention all this because the company has been busy transforming the shelter into an underground farm. It's about the environment, it's about looking at future ways to meet urban food demand, and strangely enough, it was inspired by the vertical farm movement. The co-founder of Zero Carbon Food is Stephen Dring.
Without sort of rambling on too much, there was myself and the co-founder, Rich, and business partner and friend. We would talk about population growth. We were both reading around sort of like changes in the industrial revolutions of the future. And we were looking at energy. We were looking at food production. And we were both interested in food. And yeah, over sprinkling a mixture of alcohol, we came to this idea of growing. We knew the technology existed, so we decided that growing underground was feasible.
And you've been testing the idea, haven't you, for almost 2 years. When are you likely to get it up and running?
So we have been through 18 months, 2 years of testing. We scaled it up from a really small sort of test patch down there. The horticulturalist and hydroponics expert that we were working with, or are working with, just said, get down there and start growing and you'll find out if it's absolutely feasible. So we then scaled up into a slightly larger sort of 100 square metre area, and we're just going through fundraising at the moment. And I think we've raised about 300,000 already, and we're aiming to raise £1 million, and we'll scale up in September this year.
And your farm, it's an old air raid shelter, an old World War II air raid shelter. It's, as I understand, it's about 33 metres below the surface of London. Is that correct?
Yes, it's in a place called Clapham, and it's just by the station there, and they built it as a World War II air raid shelter and literally built it during the war. And as we were sort of, being bombed, they were building this air raid shelter for people, but they built it with in mind of turning into a tube tunnel and a tube line, but that never happened, so it's just sat empty since the war.
Now, I understand in putting together this idea, you were influenced by the vertical farm movement and other urban farming movements. But what are the advantages that you saw in going underground instead of using existing high-rise buildings and trying to convert, say, one of those?
Well, when we started this, we were reading Dixon Despommier's Vertical Farm, and that kind of tuned us into this. So we knew the technology was possible, and at that time, the awful recession, but as we sort of moved through it, the price of real estate and the price of offices it just didn't stack up in terms of the numbers. And Richard knew of this underground space from some other work that he'd done. And so we kind of knew the technology would work in that environment, so we just decided to take it subterranean.
We better get you to tell us about the technology, because a lot of people will be surprised at the very notion of growing on an industrial scale plants underground, particularly at that depth.
Well, hydroponics is a really old way of growing product. It's something that's been about in farming for many years, and the technology, it's a very simple process, although it sounds very complex. It's just a case of actually just flooding the plants and seeds. So you grow on a substrate. Instead of using soil, we use an agricultural matting. You sow the seeds onto that, you leave them to propagate, and the root system starts to take place. And then you flood the benches that the matting sits in, and the water contains the nutrients that the plants need. That's a very simple sort of part of it. The tech that comes into it is from the LED light, and which has improved exponentially over sort of the last few years and will continue to improve. And they literally replicate sunlight. They replicate the spectrum of the sun. So they just emphasize and suppress elements of the light spectrum ranging from infrared to UV.
So even though the light is not natural, it functions in the same way. The technology is that good, as you say.
Absolutely. Where we get the lights from, we get them from a company in Finland. And I'm not sure if you're aware of it. In Finland, they have a very little sunlight throughout the year. So they've become very, very good at developing these lights for this kind of growing. So yeah, it literally replicates the sun.
Now, one of your goals isn't just to produce farming in an urban setting, but to produce that food without relying on any fossil fuels. Could I get you to tell us about that side of it and the challenges involved in that?
At the moment, it's just a case of buying green renewable energy. So we just buy it from a supplier who supply all their energy and generate all their energy from wind and solar PV. But we will be moving to sort of generate all of our energy on site, either through vertical wind or solar PV, or there's the potential to actually convert energy from the heat that's in the tube lines. So we have an energy consultant who is working on all of our options for that. But me and Rich, when we put this business together, we looked at future-proofing the business, and it was a case of ultimately we're running out of fossil fuels. We can enter the argument of when we're going to run out, but some people argue quite soon, some people argue many years' time. But at some stage, we will run out of fossil fuels. So it was a case of moving to a carbon-free economy, and we wanted to stick a flag in the sand and say, this is what we're doing.
And in order to produce food all year round, I presume you'd be helped by the fact that you are so far down underground, that temperature would be reasonably stable at that level.
It's constant 16 degrees all year round down there. The residual heat that comes off the back of the LED takes it up to about 18 to 22 degrees, which is the range we need to be in for growing salad crops down there at the moment. So it's a case of that environment is actually a lot more, it uses a lot less energy than growing under glass. In the UK, during the summer, we sort of pump cold air in to cool glass houses down, and during the winter, we pump heat in, and it's a sort of massive drain on energy. So, yeah, it's a really efficient environment to grow in.
Now, you're growing salad vegetables. Given the way in which you're growing them, are you limited to only certain types? I mean, how far can you go with this concept?
Hydroponically, you could literally grow an apple tree. It's just about that balance between how long it takes you to grow it and whether you could be growing something and selling it that's more profitable. When we started this business, being a startup, you can kind of choose your direction a lot more than people that are already established. And we wanted to create a social business that's engaged with the local community and brings people closer to their food and where their food comes from. Even though it's grown in a different way to an open field farm, it's still a traditional, legitimate way of growing. And so we have this social element to our business. We then have the sustainable environmental element to our business. And then we have the return for our investors as well.
And in terms of that social component, have you already made connections with local businesses that you are hoping to supply once it's up and running in September, you know, fully on stream in September?
Yes, we've already engaged with lots of wholesalers as part of our research. The local wholesalers, it's some of the larger food markets that supply London. And what attracts those guys is the fact that the produce doesn't have to travel to them for 3 to 5 days to get to them. It's something that we can get to them within 8 hours. And that provides a longer shelf life for them and a longer shelf life for their customers. And hopefully that has an impact on food waste, because we've also got an issue on food waste in the UK.
Now, it's an unusual proposal, growing food underground, particularly in an old air raid shelter. Does that turn some people off? Are they wary of the quality of the food because of the way in which it's grown?
With some people, there's some initial sort of... They certainly think about it, but if you sort of follow the concept through, a lot of people eat mushrooms that are grown in mushroom caves. They eat forced rhubarb that are grown in the dark in tunnels. So it's a food supply that people are already consuming. But yeah, first of all, there's always this concern of, well, is it dusty down there, or is there pests down there? And the fact that it's actually so low below London, there isn't any pests down there because there's so many food sources on the surface. I don't think I've ever been to a farm and never seen a rat, but I've certainly never seen one down in our tunnels. And also the fact there was 8,000 people down there during the war, so the ventilation system down there is fantastic, obviously. So, yeah, it's actually very clean air that's flowing through there. So it's something that people have, some people have initial sort of, reservations about, but actually when you follow the logic through, those reservations soon disappear.
Now, hydroponics, as you say, is a well-established technique for growing food. This idea, though, of going down, of utilising space that exists already beneath ground, how much potential do you see for that within the urban food movement? Because we certainly haven't come across it in the past. And we know about people trying to build farms vertically in towers. But this idea of growing underground is pretty niche, isn't it? It's pretty new.
We haven't come across anybody doing these kind of crops using this technology. Obviously, as I said, there's mushroom growers and rhubarb growers that are doing it underground. But no, when you read through what Dixon Despommier is saying about vertical farming, you look at population growth, certainly within the UK, we are running out of arable land. If we carry on with a carnivorous diet and population expands as it's projected to, then there is obviously considerations about the amount of land. And I think you also, there was a fairly eminent study that came out from one of the Australian universities in the last couple of weeks about soil degradation, saying that in the UK we might only have 60 years of decent topsoil left if we don't start our soil management. So this isn't a way of replacing farming, this is complementary to farming. But in terms of the urban food movement, now there's a lot of space under London. It is about shortening those food miles. It is about getting people closer to their food. We should have kids that are going to school in the UK that think spaghetti is grown on trees. So this is certainly something that we want to overcome by engaging with the local community, which we have done fairly largely already.
Well, Stephen Dring, co-founder of Zero Carbon Food, thank you very much for joining us.
Very welcome.
And if you're interested in the issue of food security and food futures, I'll be hosting a special panel session on the topic at GOMA, the Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane, on Thursday the 3rd of July. It's a free event as part of the GOMA Talk series. You'll find details on the RN website a little closer to the event. I'm Anthony Fennell, and this is Future Tense. Binge-watching television on demand is a bit of a craze at the moment, with people watching hours of shows like House of Cards all in one big hit. But what would possess someone to sit down and watch 456 episodes of Law & Order in a relatively short period of time? Jeff Thompson from the Stevens Institute of Technology in New Jersey embarked on that marathon viewing session in order to get a better understanding of the way in which modern technology has grown in importance in our lives. Jeff Thompson, welcome to Future Tense.
Oh, thank you for having me.
What convinced you that this was a good idea? How did you get interested in looking at Law & Order as a way of, I guess, chronicling the changes that have gone on with technology over the last 20 or so years?
It seems like an odd idea at first, but Law & Order happens to be this perfect format to look at our relationship to technology, how it's changed over 20 years. The show starts in 1990 and runs until 2010. So it's this kind of ideal time where we see the rise of the personal computer, people going online, laptops, smartphones, social media, these kinds of things. And a lot of it is things that you wouldn't see in literature, history, things like that. But the show has this ripped from the headlines sort of format where it's mirroring what's happening right now. And without maybe intending it, it's sort of casually documented all kinds of things like what the mice that we used look like, where the computer might be placed in a room, all these kinds of incidental things.
And it provides not just a document, if you like, on the way in which our devices changed over that very important 20-year period of development, but also the prominence those devices had in our lives.
Oh, absolutely. Or even things that supported the devices. So one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is the computer desk, which is a piece of furniture that we don't really see anymore. But anybody that used a computer in the 1990s had one. You bought it at a computer store, which was a thing then, too. It was this very specific kind of furniture. They're probably all mostly thrown in the trash because they weren't really meant to last. So it's really about our relationships to technology more than certainly Law & Order itself.
Now, Law & Order started in 1990, and right from the very beginning, there were computers there as backdrops to the action that was going on in the series. But from what I've read, it was quite a way in before those computers were actually turned on, before you actually saw people starting to use them in any meaningful way. Is that correct?
Right. So the first computer does show up in the first episode, but it's in the background. It's maybe a handful of frames of the whole episode. It takes 9 episodes until the first computer is turned on. And really for the first half of the show's run, the first 10 years, computers are mostly in the background and they're mostly turned off. So that's the kind of detail that you can pick out. Like, I remember, of course, you would turn off this thing when you were done using it because you didn't use it that much. You come to it for a specific task and now they're on constantly. And they sort of make this leap across the room onto the front of somebody's desk. I think it's in season 5 that they finally cross that threshold, which is really surprising. And they become, of course, more and more prominent in storylines along the way. Not only was I taking screenshots of computers, but also recording quotations, people talking about computers, so interesting quotes and things like that, which also reflect more of an interest in the storylines about computers, hacking, games, that kind of stuff. And then, of course, the transition from these clunky big old monitors to laptops and things like that. And then by the end of the show, we see this rise of the iPhone and Blackberries and things like that. So they don't play as much of a role as I was expecting. I think there's other shows that have more almost a sci-fi sort of take on technology where tablets and gestural interfaces and things play more of a role. Law & Order ends up being, I think, more accurate, more gritty, sort of. They're maybe a year or two behind on the technology because it's mostly, government offices and things like that.
And that was one of the interesting things about the Law & Order program, wasn't it? That it very much in a way reflected the issues that were occurring in the United States at the time. It was very contemporary in that sense.
Absolutely. I mean, I like to think that it reflects both our fascinations and our fears about things. So we see the police engage hackers in a positive way where they're helping them out. And then we see other things like certainly social media. The show really reflects this kind of fear or worry about what those interactions might be. Online commerce, especially this kind of networked or online sort of things. I think the show really does reflect a lot of the anxiety we had about those technologies. I got very lucky in that case. The show has this perfect format and it happens to align with this kind of perfect time for it. Somebody had asked me, would there be other shows that somebody could look at and do a similar kind of analysis? And I can't think of anything else that would be situated for this particular investigation, though, you might be able to watch a show like, The Office or Battlestar Galactica and find a completely different trajectory through it.
Now, I'm sure some people are going to be interested, not just in your research, but how you actually went about capturing these images, taking these screenshots. 456 episodes of Law & Order. Take us through your research method. How long did it take?
It took a year and a half, and I was watching actually at 150% speed through the whole thing. I think there's like 120 DVDs worth of show, and binge watching at this kind of magnitude requires specialized hardware. And so I built a sort of touch sensor bar that I could reach out and hit with my hand, and it would pause the video and take 5 screenshots automatically. I wrote some software as well that kind of handles a lot of that stuff. So, with that many images, it really required a lot of planning ahead of time to be able to deal with that amount of data. You know, each one of the images is tagged with the season and episode number and the exact time in the episode, so somebody could recreate or go back into the episode and find that same image.
And all of those images, all of those screenshots are now up there online for people to see if they want to go and see them. How do you expect that they will be used? I mean, what's the future value of this research?
You know, I think that's a great question. And as someone who identifies as an artist, I like that I don't really know the answer to that. I know that I find things through this archive that we can pull out about our relationships to technology, about the kind of spaces we use computers in or these kinds of technologies. I think there's a lot of other things that could be pulled out from the show or even from the archive I've put together. And I like that it asks us to find things in it rather than kind of give us a definitive, this is what Computers on Law and Order tells us.
But would you do it again?
Would I do it again? I think you might have to ask me again in a few months.
Jeff Thompson, thank you very much for joining us on Future Tense.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And I should just mention that there's a link to Assistant Professor Thompson's work on our website. It was supported with funding from Rhizome, a non-profit arts organisation that supports and provides platforms for new media art.
The edge of change. New ideas, new approaches, new technologies. This is Future Tense on RN and online.
TK421, report in. TK421. TK421, report in. Have you located the Museum of Science Fiction?
No, not yet, sir. We're still looking.
Lord Vader will not accept excuses. Find the Museum of Science Fiction and the plans for that mobile application. And find them now!
As you can tell by that little online promotional video, the Museum of Science Fiction is not actually built yet. It's still an ambition. But one of the brains behind it, Greg Viggiano, is feverishly working to get it up and running, at least in initial form, by 2015. He and his colleagues have been raising funds for the new centre, and they have their eyes fixed on Washington, D.C. as its home. They're billing it as the world's first dedicated large-scale museum of sci-fi. Greg Viggiano.
We're thinking of it as using it as an educational tool and also as a traditional museum to house science fiction artifacts and display objects. And we'd like to do it on a large scale, on a comprehensive scale, to really put in place what might not exist right now. And we're prepared to go about it in a couple of different ways. We'll have some very definite educational programming to go along, but we're also going to use tools such as mobile devices and wireless-enabled display objects in the museum, both to have a lot of fun with for visitors, but also use as teaching tools for students that are going to be coming through to the museum.
Can you give us a sense of the sorts of themes and exhibits that you'd like to have in the museum?
Well, sure. What we have structured right now in terms of our exhibit planning and visitor experience planning is an arrangement of seven galleries. The first gallery being the creatives and the people that created various science fiction stories, going from the beginning to more present-day contemporary stories. And then what we think of as more traditional-type science fiction, where we have a gallery set up for vehicles and other worlds, technology, aliens, computers and robots, and time travel.
Now, as a non-American, tell me that it won't predominantly focus on American science fiction. Will you be including science fiction from other countries, other cultures?
Oh, most definitely, because we do not want this to be a U.S.-centric institution. So much science fiction has come from offshore. The Australians, the British, the Japanese have all been major contributors, even going back to the original science fiction stories, such as like Mary Shelley and Jules Verne, were both British and French, respectively. And we need to make sure that this is definitely not an American-only institution. We're definitely trying to present a much more balanced approach. So not just film and television, we'll be going into music, art, literature, and also video games. And when we say literature, we're not just talking about the novels that have been written, but also comics and graphic novels and other things that have been written in short stories to make sure that we bring a very comprehensive and balanced portrayal of science fiction.
Now, science fiction fans have a reputation for being very passionate and sometimes obsessive. Are you confident, though, that you'll be able to satisfy those diehard fans?
Well, we're going to try, and our approach has been a very approachable and grassroots type of planning process. And we're constantly reaching out to the different science fiction communities and sub-communities to make sure that we're getting their input early in our planning process. And actually, that's one of the reasons why we wanted to start with a preview museum, which is only going to be about 3,000 square feet as we plan the larger 50,000 square foot facility, so we can use that as a prototype and kind of a test bed and collect more feedback and more input from the different fan communities to make sure that we actually get it right.
So the establishment of the museum will be staggered in a sense. You'll have, as you say, this preview museum leading on to a much more permanent, larger museum in the future.
That's correct.
Your personal motivations. Why are you so keen on this idea? What does it mean to you?
I come from an educational background, and I've done a bit of teaching along with my my professional career. And I think that a museum like this could be a perfect learning tool because science fiction is so rich and can be used as a teaching mechanism to get kids motivated in some of these more conceptually difficult areas in school that always gave me a lot of trouble. And I think if we were to take an approach where using science fiction and using some of the things that we're planning to put in the museum as a teaching tool and an easier way to understand these more conceptually sophisticated areas, it might make a difference in how people, how students choose their career paths.
What sort of contact have you had with other organizations, and what sort of input have already established organizations had into the planning of this museum?
Well, we're getting an incredible, enthusiastic response. We've reached out to a number of existing museums that have covered science fiction, and they are very supportive and ready to roll up their sleeves to help us put this museum in place. Different fan communities and artist communities have come forward. The volunteer effort has been off the charts, terrific. We have a group of about 170 volunteers with very impressive professional backgrounds that want to help in just about every aspect of the museum planning.
Well, Greg Vigiano, I know for a fact that there are a lot of science fiction fans who listen to Future Tense, and I'm sure they'll be interested to follow the progress of the museum. And we'll try to come back to you as it gets a little bit closer, as you get established.
Please do. I'd love to report the progress to you.
Thanks for your time.
Take care.
And that's Future Tense for another week. Thanks to my co-producer, Andrew Davies, and this week's sound engineer, Jim Usher. I'll be back again next week. Until then, cheers and goodbye.
The men who built the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Here they are, hundreds of feet.
The Sydney Harbour Bridge now has a submerged counterpart.
For decades, infrastructure was built and owned by state governments and their authorities. Today, it's very different.
The Federal Treasurer, Joe Hockey, has offered extra infrastructure funding to states that sell off government-owned assets.
The story of infrastructure, how it used to be built and how it's done today. You can download or stream this revision from the RN website.